You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The Oath, a new film by Oscar-nominated documentary filmmaker Laura Poitras, provides a rare opportunity for Western audiences to become familiar with the way al-Qaeda members see the world through the eyes of a man who served as Osama bin Laden's bodyguard. I'm very pleased that Ms. Poitras joins me now to discuss her film, which opens at IFC on 6th Avenue and West 3rd Street tonight. Welcome to our show.
It's so great to be here.
This is the second film in a trilogy that you're working on about the U.S. post 9/11. Did working on this film affect your views on the war on terror?
Well, it does. I mean, you know, what I'm trying to do with the work is to take these, you know, big themes that we're debating that have changed the direction of this country and understand them through the lives of the people who are living them. And so you learn something different when you do that. So by going to Iraq and spending time with an Iraqi family, you understand the occupation differently than you do sitting back here and talking about it. And the same thing with The Oath, you know, entering into this world.
Was making a film about a former al-Qaeda member your original idea?
It actually wasn't. I'm not quite that crazy to sort of think that I'm going to get on a plane and look for bin Laden's former bodyguard. The way that it sort of unfolded is I went to Yemen looking for a story about Guantanamo.
Mm-hmm. And you were going to do a film about Guantanamo.
Yeah. And so I didn't, you know, sort of look. I wasn't looking for this guy. But I found myself sitting across the room from him. And it's one of those things as a storyteller, it was hard to turn away from. So, I mean, if you found yourself, for instance, sitting across from bin Laden's former bodyguard, you'd be like, oh, this is kind of interesting. So maybe we could talk. And finding out that he's a taxi driver was actually also interesting.
And, of course, he was very forthcoming, and that was something that you couldn't have predicted.
Right. You certainly couldn't have predicted. And he is forthcoming, and he's spoken. Obviously, it's part of the film that we see him talking to the media. But I needed something different. You know, like the first thing I wanted to do was put a camera in his taxi cab. I mean, this is a taxi cab driver who's bin Laden's bodyguard. That's, you know, what happens when he picks up passengers. I mean, I was really interested in that. And that took some time. That you know, I had to be really patient to make that happen.
Most of the story then takes place in Yemen, and we see it through the lens of Abu Jandal, this man we're talking about. Was he cooperative from the start?
You know, I mean, you see it in the film that he is clearly not shy to talk. But to get the kind of access, that really did take time. And there was always a sense that this was somebody who was hiding something. And, you know, that becomes part of the film, that we wanted to sort of get beneath his sort of public persona.
Yeah, he seems to be putting on a show at times. Mm-hmm. He's very aware of that camera.
Right.
You also follow the story of Salim Hamdan, the first man to be tried by the military tribunals at Guantanamo. He's now released and back in Yemen. Mm-hmm. Did you try to contact him?
Well, I mean, Hamdan in the film is really a ghost for most of the film. And that was, you know, we wanted to have that, these sort of parallel stories of one man who's missing and one man who's present. And then these questions of, like, why is one imprisoned and the other is free? I mean, that's kind of one of the central themes of the film. In terms of Hamdan's story, it also is looking at these military commissions, which are certainly being debated now in terms of what to do with Guantanamo and for instance, what's going to happen with the 9/11 trials.
You include a clip where Salim Hamdan's lawyer says in a press conference that he's worried no one would see Hamdan as the gracious, kind person he is, who made some mistakes. Was that your worry with Abu Jandal?
Rephrase the question.
Well, I mean, he doesn't come across as the kind, gracious person.
No, and he's not intended to. I mean, I think that this is a film that is, you know, the protagonist is an antihero, but we wanted to go inside that world. I mean, that seemed to be important, and these kinds of details. I mean, as you'll see in the film, that he's surrounded by these young men who seek advice from him, and it's just really important to understand these kind of minutia information, how he raises his kid, what he believes in, and also why he, you know, he turned away. But certainly it presented challenges as a filmmaker.
Well, I don't think he was aware that he's the anti-hero of this film.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, that's probably true.
He attracted a lot of attention for the information that he provided to the FBI after 9/11. Why did his testimony stand out more than other members who were questioned?
Well, I mean, I think this is a really significant interrogation, and it's something Elie Zufan, who some of your listeners might know about, is an FBI agent who interrogated Abu Jandal less than a week after 9/11. And
how did he even get him?
Well, it's a fascinating story, and Lawrence Wright writes about it in The Looming Tower. But Elie Zufan was investigating the coal bombing. He happened to be in Yemen on 9/11. His former boss, John O'Neill, who used to work for the FBI and was one of the lead people in trying to raise awareness about al-Qaeda before 9/11, actually died in the World Trade Center because he was working in security there. And Elie Zufan, you know, whose boss had, you know, just died, was in Yemen, and he started just talking to many people who were in prison there to try to get any kind of information. And he stumbled into Abu Jandal. And it's just an incredibly significant interrogation. It's not just for the information it provided, but I think for us as Americans, it's really important to understand it because this was done without the use of torture.
Well, why do you think that a committed al-Qaeda member, former or otherwise, right, cooperated with the FBI and now with a Western journalist?
Right. Well, I mean, I don't want to give away too much of the film, but I think, I mean, here was somebody, he was in prison. He was imprisoned in 2000, and so he didn't know what was going on. And I think when the Yemeni guards and Elie Zufan came into his cell and presented him with the photographs from 9/11, he didn't believe it. I think he was in the same kind of shock that the rest of the world was. And I think that even though, you know, these were the people he worked with, I think he was shocked, and that is partly why he turned away.
Well, in the beginning of the film, he defends the September 11th attacks, mm-hmm, but he didn't participate in them, and eventually, as we said, provided the FBI with a lot of useful information in the aftermath. It sounds kind of contradictory. Was it just a matter of him feeling that the September 11th was going too far?
I mean, the contradictions, you can interpret them in different ways, and we actually want the audience to do that. But I think that there was some face saving going on. I mean, imagine, for instance, that you had something that you were hiding. One of the things you might do is, you know, present a different story of events. And I think that's what's going on a lot with Abu Jandal, which isn't to say that he's repentant. I mean, he's clearly not. But I do think he has tactical differences in terms of, you know, targeting civilians, and that's what we try to reveal in the film.
Well, he not only left al-Qaeda, he broke the oath, which is the source of the title of your film.
Right. I mean, that's in question. Yeah, I think that he there's clearly a lot of guilt on his part, both in terms of his loyalty or lack thereof to bin Laden, and also to Salim Hamdan, who's his close friend.
Do we know whether other people had similar feelings? I mean, here he is in general agreement with al-Qaeda's goals and close to Osama bin Laden, right, but he leaves because he thinks the group is going too far.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that's a theme that you'll hear. And I mean, I do think the insight or one of the lessons that you have is that here's somebody who's so close who turned away. And then you look at the U.S. response, you know, for instance, the occupation of Iraq, the invasion of occupation of Iraq, which has created a whole new generation of people who've been radicalized. And when you kind of look at that next to someone like Abu Jandal, who was so close, and even he turned away, you know, it really makes you wonder, like, what is our approach to dealing with al-Qaeda? And in what sense are we radicalizing more people with a group that doesn't, in its sort of inner circle, have agreement? And that's one of the sort of conundrums that the film poses.
My guest is Laura Poitras, whose film is called The Oath, and it opens today at the IFC on 6th Avenue and West 3rd Street. He says something that he later asks you to delete, mm-hmm, but you keep it in. Why didn't you delete it?
I'm curious. What did you think about it?
Well, I mean, obviously it was something that you must have been tortured about taking out.
You know, it was certainly something that we talked about. I mean, this was a need to know. I mean, the question that I left in, and I'm not going to give away what the question is, was certainly a need to know. And, you know, my feeling about it in this circumstance, I mean, here's somebody who's highly trained, very intelligent, very capable of giving consent. If I were, for instance, speaking to someone in the government, for instance, you know, Donald Rumsfeld, and he asked me to delete something, of course, you know, no, there would be no expectation that I would delete it. And I think that if you have somebody who's, you know, acting on the political stage at the level that he was, things like that are on the record.
Well, he is a taxi driver, but do you think he was framing his answers specifically for a Western audience?
I don't know. I mean, I think that there is, I mean, what we, there are shades. And there are times where we provide the viewer with warning signs that we show him, for instance, lying. And we wanted you to know, we want the audience to know that he's actually quite a savvy liar. But I think that there also is a lot of truth. And so there's a moment where he sort of shows his appreciation for Western-made goods, you know, that they make things with conscience. And unlike, you know, Yemenis who, you know, are sons of donkeys, and I think that there's something that he has.
Other jihadists who are attracted to him, they talk about how American soft drinks are better than Yemeni soft drinks.
Yeah, for me, you know, like I mean, even in terms of his relationship with me, I mean, he will say that, you know, the West, or you know, he hates the policy of the West, but I think he actually, you know, here I was, an American journalist coming to Yemen. I'd spent eight months in Iraq filming that. I think he actually had some respect for the work that I was doing, which is probably why I got the access that I got. And I think that that's real. I think that it's not just his manipulation, which isn't to say he's not manipulative.
Well, he also probably felt some, he thought maybe you were a bit more sympathetic to what he was saying than some other journalists might have been.
I think, I'm not sure if it was sympathetic, more so that I was going to spend the time and try to say something that was more complicated than, you know, sound bites.
Well, do you, in thinking a lot about jihadists, because he's there, other people in Yemen you met, do you think that all jihadists have certain things in common? Did they all have goals similar to al-Qaeda?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think you have to understand this in a spectrum of those people who are really hardcore and are in it for life, and those people who are attracted to it, but maybe are not acting on it. I mean, I think that the people who gather around him, he's telling them not to go to Iraq. There were a lot of young men who were going to Iraq while I was filming there.
Why is he telling them not to go to Iraq?
I think he thinks that it's that they are being used and that they would be fodder and that they're not grounded in any kind of ideological, philosophical, religious foundation. And I mean, and I do think that we have to, you know, that there is a new generation of people who are being radicalized, and that they're being radicalized not by, you know, the teachings of religious scholars, but really by events that have happened post 9/11, and that there is this attraction. And I saw it in Yemen all the time. I mean, there were young guys that were going to Iraq to fight, and they would come home as heroes. I mean, it's quite frightening.
Is being a jihadist or part of al-Qaeda something that you would be open about in Yemen?
How do you mean?
I mean, would people just say, I'm ready to go off to the jihad, or is this something that you try to keep secret?
No, I mean, I think that they definitely keep it secret, for sure. But there was definitely recruiting going on. I mean, the young guys would tell me that there were other people. Abu Jandal was telling them, stay put, get an education, and other people were trying to recruit them. So it's in the air, but no, people are not open about it.
My guest is Laura Poitras, whose latest film is called The Oath. It opens today at the IFC on 6th Avenue and West 3rd Street. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Laura Poitras, whose film The Oath is opening today at the IFC. It has already been featured at Sundance and at the Berlinale Film Festival. How does the Yemeni government treat jihadists? Do they ever arrest them?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that there is sort of a lot of deal-making that goes on. I mean, I think the Yemen government is trying to stay in power, and it makes deals across the board. So it's not unlike Pakistan. So it's in relationship. It's accepting funds from the United States. It's partnering with the United States in counterterrorism. At the same time, there's sympathy within the government for radical forces, including al-Qaeda. So there's a lot of deal-making going on. And it's, you know, sort of pragmatic to stay in power. And I think right now, I mean, there has been recently with the pressure in Pakistan, people who have been migrating al-Qaeda into Yemen, into tribal areas. And I think that the government is aware that that's going to be a problem for them.
It's possible there in the same way that it's possible in the tribal areas of Pakistan, because there is very little government control. In the case of Yemen, mm-hmm. there's even something of a civil war going on.
Yeah, there's civil war going on, and there's very, very, very strong tribal bonds. And so what you have is, you know, people who are seeking safe haven, they're getting it. But I think that it's what happens often in these sort of tribal relationships. If they find it's not in their interest, they will no longer provide haven. And I think that that's what Yemen's trying to deal with right now.
Well, Yemen has also come up with the Dialogue Committee,
mm-hmm.
started that in 2003, mm-hmm. as a way of dealing with the growing jihadist problem.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very pragmatic approach to deal with radicalism that they know that they have. And there were a number of people in jail. There were hundreds when Abu Jandal was there, and they made a deal with them. And there was it was also a dialogue. I mean, they brought in this respected religious cleric to talk and say, well, you know what, maybe it's not a good idea to target Yemen, and that Yemen is not, you know, a legitimate target for al-Qaeda. And I think that there's a range. I mean, I do think that there were some changing of opinions, but I think it's also very sort of behavioral. Like, they're like, if you sign this, we'll let you out and promise not to, you know, to keep doing this stuff. And I think Abu Jandal, he signed this agreement. He was released from prison. The Yemen government gave him money to buy his taxi cab, which is interesting. And
especially for a government that is so strapped for cash.
Yeah. And
they're buying these people off, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. And which is, I think, what the United States did in Iraq when they gave the Sunnis a whole bunch of money.
Do you think that this has been successful? I mean, Abu Jandal seems to be serious about being a taxi driver.
I think it has been successful for those who wanted to turn away and start a new life, and I think he was one of those. I think partly because he was in solitary confinement for so long. And so I think there are several people. It gives people a face-saving way to leave that life, and that's a good thing. And it's a problem if people can't actually earn a living. I mean, there has to be some kind of way if people want to turn away, if you don't have evidence against that they've committed crimes. Well, it's a good thing if they actually have a way to have a source of income. So to give them a taxi cab, there was some, you know, there's some logic there.
Someone in your movie calls Yemen an ideological marketplace.
Actually, Abu Jandal. He's talking to Robert Worth from the New York Times, and and I think that there are various radical movements going, you know, bubbling under the surface.
Now, you talked about Abu Jandal meeting with these young wannabe jihadists. Is that kind of activity consistent with the stipulations of the Dialogue Committee?
Well, Abu Jandal's under pretty close surveillance, so I'm sure that if he was doing anything that sort of broke that, he would hear about it. So I think that they know, and I think that it's, talk is different than action.
You also filmed some of the meetings that he had with these young people.
Yeah.
They're critical of the U.S., but as you said, they also appreciate the fact that the United States produces some things that are better than the Yemenite brands.
Right.
Were you surprised that they let you come into the meetings?
I was very surprised. I mean, I think that that's probably one of the most unique things about the film, to have this insight of these young men. And I also think it's important to note that they actually argue with him often. I mean, they're the ones, it's like, you know, what's the point of attacking civilians and they're innocent? And those were the questions that they're posing to him. And it was pretty rare. And I think that it was interesting for me because Abu Jandal, when he was in Afghanistan, was a guest house emir. He was the emir of hospitality. And his job was to receive young men who were coming to Afghanistan, and then he would decide what to do with them. And I think that that was part of his disillusionment with actually leaving, why he left Afghanistan. It was because he was seeing young people coming there without a sense of purpose and being used as fodder.
In fact, he also thinks of this younger generation as being too impulsive.
He does, and he's on a hit list from the younger generation. I mean, they're not happy with him.
A real hit list? They want to kill him because he disagrees?
I think I just got an email from somebody who works in intelligence, who knows very well, and he saw the film, and he said he basically verified the danger that Abu Jandal must be in speaking so publicly.
My guest is Laura Poitras. Her film, The Oath, opens at the IFC today. Let's get back to the other character, that you're dealing with. He did wind up going back to Yemen. Are many of them sent? Was he from Yemen in the first place?
Salim Hamdan, yeah. He's from Yemen, and he was the first person to go through the military tribunal. There have been two people who struck a deal before that, but he was tried at the military commissions at Guantanamo, and I think to everyone's surprise got a very time served and a short sentence after that.
What has he really done other than be a driver?
That's what he'd done. And I think that's the question that the film poses. What are the levels? What are war crimes? I think at Nuremberg, there weren't the cooks and the drivers. There were the people that were being held accountable. And then also, I think the legitimacy of the military commissions itself gets called into question. And I'd actually like to say something about that, because we're now, Omar Khadr's military commission is now happening at Guantanamo, which is, the rules were rewritten once again, and the rule book wasn't delivered to the journalist and the prosecution covering the trial until the night before. And I just wonder, why are we pursuing this legal path which hasn't withstood legal scrutiny? I mean, why do we want to take – I mean, the federal courts actually have worked. I mean, I find it really surprising that there's so much national debate about not bringing people to federal court. We have the two cases that are happening in the U.S. now where there's outcry in Congress about, sending them to military commissions. I'm like, do we really want to send people to military commissions that have been struck down by the Supreme Court? I mean, the federal
courts... also seem to not punish people with the kind of severity that the civilian courts
exactly.
do.
Exactly. I mean, material support for terrorism, which was what John Walker Lind was convicted of, got 20 years and not that he deserved it, but 20 years in a federal court sentence, where Salim Hamdan got time served in 5 months at Guantanamo in a military commission. And I think his conviction is actually very questionable, because he was convicted of crimes that were created as crimes after his Supreme Court victory. So I think his whole case could be completely overturned. And it's just very perplexing, because actually the legal system has been doing a good job in sort of post 9/11. The lawyers have been doing a good job. The military, I mean, there have been so many people who've been heroes in this story that have basically said, we have a rule of law, we have a constitution, this is what we believe in, and it actually works. And the government, for whatever reason, has decided to throw those things out the window.
What's the link between Abu Jandal and Salim Hamdan?
It's a fascinating story, and it was actually the thing that really drew me to wanting to tell Abu Jandal's story. So Abu Jandal is a Yemeni, but born in Saudi Arabia at the age of 19.
He's part Somali too, isn't he?
His dad is mixed Somali Yemeni. He's born in Saudi Arabia. At the age of 19, decided with his friend to pack up his bags, throw everything out the window, and go to Bosnia. He just said to his dad, he's going to go play soccer. Went to Bosnia to fight jihad and trained there in 93. And then from there, decided to go to Somalia. Didn't like it there. Then went through, was back in Yemen, and decided he wanted to go to Tajikistan. And when he was in Yemen, he joined with a group of people, and he happened to have met Salim Hamdan in the streets in Yemen, who was not ideologically motivated, who was driving a cab, very poor, orphaned. And he just said, okay, here is somebody who was willing to, pay his way. He was a friend. Abu Jandal is obviously very charming. And so he just said, okay. So he went, and they went to Afghanistan, and they were turned away at the border at Tajikistan, and bin Laden had just been kicked out of the Sudan and was resetting up roots in Afghanistan. And he heard that there was a group from the Arabian Peninsula that were in the country, and he said, come visit, because he was looking for people who I think there were a lot of Egyptians, and he wanted people from his homeland.
Were Yemen as well.
And the story, according to Abu Jandal, when he met there were two men he was introduced to when he was met to bin Laden, and he mistook the wrong person for bin Laden, so he didn't even know who he was. But they ended up staying, and Hamdan became a driver, and Abu Jandal became a personal bodyguard and a guest house.
But he also we see him with his family.
Yeah.
And we see him kind of indoctrinating his own son to think about jihad in the future.
Right. Yeah.
This is a mixed bag, man.
He's absolutely a mixed bag. He's absolutely. And they were further connected, I should say this, which is a fascinating story. I think Abu Jandal wanted to leave, and bin Laden wanted them to stay. And he said, well, go marry sisters, the Yemeni sisters. And they did. And then they
So now they're brother-in-law.
They're brother-in-law.
It's interesting that the Yemen branch of Al-Qaeda was behind the attempted airplane suicide attack on Christmas.
Right.
So is Yemen still sending people out?
Well, I mean, this is the sort of newly formed Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. I think that there is, you know, they're doing training there, and the government's very aware of that. Abu Jandal has spoken out against them. I don't think he has direct ties. But there, it's certainly a place where people are going to. But there is a bit of a power vacuum.
Now, Hamdan and Jandal are no longer friends.
Well, no, of course they are.
Didn't he feel a bit betrayed by
them? Of course he did. But I think that they probably spend every Friday together. I mean, they're family. Mm-hmm. And I think they're bound to each other, and they have very different ways of dealing with their histories, but they're close.
In the film, there's a clip from a CNN interview from 1998. Where Abu Jandal says the West will soon know Osama bin Laden's name. Did people in Yemen know his name before September 11th?
It's actually an ABC interview.
Oh.
Did people in the West?
I thought his name was kind of known in the West, but was he already a celebrity in Yemen, although he had come out of Saudi Arabia?
I don't think so. I mean, I don't think that he. Was known sort of on the popular public level.
Obviously, September 11th kind of forced people to take sides throughout these countries.
Right.
Do you see Yemen as a polarized country?
I mean, what I think that pretty much, I think most people after 9/11 had enormous sympathy for the United States. I mean, I really think they did, and they were shocked and outraged by this violent attack. And I think that was the sentiment. However, things did change, and things changed, I think, in response to the occupation of Iraq and Abu Ghraib photographs and the existence of Guantanamo. I mean, we really cannot underestimate how much ill will we've created in our response. And I think the opposite of making us more secure, I think if you're radicalizing more people, there are crazy people out there, and you don't really want to give them a reason to act on that. And I think that there are some people, I mean, clearly there are people who are doing their best and don't sleep at night worrying about these things and you know, trying to do the right thing. But I also think that there have been, you know, really huge mistakes. I mean, how do things like Abu Ghraib happen? I mean, it's really quite shocking. And
Alex Gibney made a film about some of the horrors that we've been involved with.
An incredible film. And he actually has a film coming out today and looking at, you know, sort of corruption within the U.S. government. And,
well, we had him on the other day to talk about Jack Abramoff.
Yeah, tremendous film and frightening. I mean, really frightening. It makes you realize, like, oh, okay, well, this is what the government's up to. They're going on vacation
Well, not everybody in the government.
No, not everybody. But it should be said that not one member of Congress has resigned over everything that's come out. These are things that are happening in our name. I mean, it's not just about political left, right, you know, politics. This is the United States is engaged in activity that is, you know, against our principles and constitution for a number of years. And I don't think that our leaders have been taking a stand.
You obviously put yourself in danger when you shot the film in Iraq. Was Yemen dangerous?
Yeah, well, they were dangerous.
You were there 8 months.
I was in Iraq for 8 months. They were different in very, very. They were dangerous and different in very different ways. Baghdad was, I'm sure, more physically dangerous. I mean, to go out on the street in Baghdad was to risk your life. To go to a cafe would be a death wish as an American. In Yemen,
as an American woman, or just as an American?
When I was there, I mean, you know, there was targeting of journalists and beheadings going on, and so I was filming there, you know, at great risk, and, you know, had to calculate every time I, you know, went on the streets whether or not it was worth taking that risk. And that's the environment in Baghdad when I was there. Now, Yemen is different. Yemen, I was living alone. I was renting a house. I was taking taxi cabs. I was going to the market. I'd go to, you know, I mean, I had a life. There was definitely targeting of Americans, and there has been sort of increasing, that's been increasing, sadly, because it's really an amazing country. I mean, I miss it, and you know, and look forward to going back. But there were these, I felt with this film, in a sense, more anxious because there's really sort of all these psychological layers. You didn't, you know, Abu Jandal was kind of, you didn't know, you know. I mean, there, I mean, if you imagine, you know, going to someone's house who was Bin Laden's bodyguard, that's, you know, it's somewhat of a frightening thing, and you can't not think about, you know, that you might be walking into a trap. And so that was kind of always hovering, and not just even if I were to trust him, but there was other people, you know, if the wrong people found out I was there, it could have got it could have gone bad.
Well, we recently spoke to an Italian journalist who was captured by the Taliban in a trap. These things happen all the time.
Right, exactly.
A listener asks if it's true that you found yourself on the United States no-fly list after the oath opened.
I can't. I mean, the government doesn't tell you. You know, I mean, I have had problems traveling. When I come back, I go through certain screening. And when I was going to travel to Berlin, I was told I wasn't authorized to travel. And my lawyer made some phone calls, and I did get on the plane, which suggests that I'm not on a no-fly list. I've been stopped. Every time I return back to the United States, I'm met at the plane by people from Border Protection, and you know, and I'm questioned, and my notes are photocopied, and you know, I have mixed feelings about it. On one hand, the government, I mean, I am hitting nerves, right? So it's not surprising that the government would be curious, or that I would, you know, they would want to know what I'm up to.
But this is not a pro-jihad film.
No, it's not. And you know, and I'm a journalist. It's like, it's really hard to make documentaries. It's not a cover for anything else. I'm just trying to tell stories and trying to tell, you know, capture primary documents. I mean, I think we have a lot of, you know, arguments about these issues, but I think having a record on the ground of what's happening is actually very valuable for us to understand the world in which we're living, and that's the work I'm trying to do. So yes, I've been stopped at the airport over 20 times. They're usually very polite. Sometimes not as polite as others. I know they're just doing their job. I do wish there was some sort of an appeal process. And when I was told I couldn't fly to Berlin to show the movie at the Berlin Film Festival, that was actually a bit of a shock. But I did get on the plane. So. Which all suggests, according to my legal counsel, who's also curiously represents Valerie Wilson, so he actually knows quite a bit about this world. He says, "I'm not on a no-fly list. I'm actually just a subject to enhanced scrutiny."
Laura Poitras was nominated for an Oscar, an Independent Spirit Award, and an Emmy Award for her film My Country, My Country, which is a documentary about the U.S. occupation of Iraq. Her latest is The Oath, and it opens today at the IFC on 6th Avenue and West 3rd Street. And I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.